John D. Ashcroft, Attorney General versus the Free Speech Coalition on writ of certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Justice Kennedy delivered the opinion of the court April 16, 2002. We consider in this case whether the Child Pornography Prevention Act of 1996, CPPA, abridges the freedom of speech. The CPPA extends the federal prohibition against child pornography to sexually explicit images that appear to depict minors but were produced without using any real children. The statute prohibits, in specific circumstances, possessing or distributing these images, which may be created by using adults who look like minors or by using computer imaging. The new technology, according to Congress, makes it possible to create realistic images of children who do not exist. See Congressional Findings Notes following 18 U.S.C. 2251. By prohibiting child pornography that does not depict an actual child, the statute goes beyond New York versus Ferber, which distinguished child pornography from other sexually explicit speech because of the state's interest in protecting the children exploited by the production process. As a general rule, pornography can be banned only if obscene, but under Ferber, pornography showing minors can be proscribed whether or not the images are obscene, under the definition set forth in Miller versus California. Ferber recognized that the Miller standard, like all general definitions of what may be banned as obscene, does not reflect the state's particular and more compelling interest in prosecuting those who promote the sexual exploitation of children. While we have not had occasion to consider the question, we may assume that the apparent age of persons engaged in sexual conduct is relevant to whether a depiction offends community standards. Pictures of young children engaged in certain acts might be obscene, where similar depictions of adults or perhaps even older adolescents would not. The CPPA, however, is not directed at speech that is obscene. Congress has proscribed those materials through a separate statute. Like the law in Ferber, the CPPA seeks to reach beyond obscenity, and it makes no attempt to conform to the Miller standard. For instance, the statute would reach visual depictions such as movies, even if they have redeeming social value. The principal question to be resolved, then, is whether the CPPA is constitutional, where it proscribes a significant universe of speech that is neither obscene under Miller nor child pornography under Ferber. Part 1. Before 1996, Congress defined child pornography as the type of depictions at issue in Ferber, images made using actual minors. The CPPA retains that prohibition and adds three other prohibited categories of speech, of which the first and the third are at issue in this case. Section 22568B prohibits any visual depiction, including any photograph, film, video, picture, or computer-generated image or picture, that is or appears to be of a minor engaging in sexually explicit conduct. The prohibition on any visual depiction does not depend at all on how the image is produced. The section captures a range of depictions, sometimes called virtual child pornography, which include computer-generated images as well as images produced by more traditional means. For instance, the literal terms of the statute embrace a Renaissance painting depicting a scene from classical mythology, a picture that appears to be of a minor engaging in sexually explicit conduct. The statute also prohibits Hollywood movies filmed without any child actors if a jury believes an actor appears to be a minor engaged in actual or simulated sexual intercourse. These images do not involve, let alone harm, any children in the production process, but Congress decided the materials threaten children in other less direct ways. Pedophiles might use the materials to encourage children to participate in sexual activity. A child who is reluctant to engage in sexual activity with an adult or to pose for sexually explicit photographs can sometimes be convinced by viewing depictions of other children having fun participating in such activity, according to congressional findings. Furthermore, pedophiles might whet their own sexual appetites with the pornographic images, thereby increasing the creation and distribution of child pornography and the sexual abuse and exploitation of actual children. Under these rationales, harm flows from the content of the images, not from the means of their production. In addition, Congress identified another problem created by computer-generated images. Their existence can make it harder to prosecute pornographers who do use real minors. As imaging technology improves, Congress found, it becomes more difficult to prove that a particular picture was produced using actual children. To ensure that defendants possessing child pornography using real minors cannot evade prosecution, Congress extended the ban to virtual child pornography. Section 2256(8)(c) prohibits a more common and lower-tech means of creating virtual images known as computer morphing. Rather than creating original images, pornographers can alter innocent pictures of real children so that the children appear to be engaged in sexual activity. Although morphed images may fall within the definition of virtual child pornography, they implicate the interests of real children and are in that sense closer to the images in fervor. Respondents do not challenge this provision, and we do not consider it. Respondents do challenge Section 2256(8)(d). Like the text of the appears to be provision, the sweep of this provision is quite broad. Section 2256(8)(d) defines child pornography to include any sexually explicit image that was advertised, promoted, presented, described, or distributed in such a manner that conveys the impression it depicts a minor engaging in sexually explicit conduct. One committee report identified the provision as directed at sexually explicit images pandered as child pornography. Quote, this provision prevents child pornographers and pedophiles from exploiting prurient interests in child sexuality and sexual activity through the production or distribution of pornographic material, which is intentionally pandered as child pornography, unquote. The statute is not so limited in its reach, however, as it punishes even those possessors who took no part in pandering. Once a work has been described as child pornography, the taint remains on the speech in the hands of subsequent possessors, making possession unlawful even though the content otherwise would not be objectionable. Fearing that the CTPA threatened the activities of its members, Respondent Free Speech Coalition and others challenged the statute in the United States District Court for the Northern District of California. The coalition, the California Trade Association for the Adult Entertainment Industry, alleged that its members did not use minors in their sexually explicit works, but they believed some of the materials might fall within the CTPA's expanded definition of child pornography. The other respondents are Bold Type, Inc., a publisher of a book advocating the nudist lifestyle, Jim Gingrich, a painter of nudes, and Ron Raffaele, a photographer specializing in erotic images. Respondents allege that the appears to be and conveys the impression provisions are overbroad and vague, chilling them from producing works protected by the First Amendment. The district court disagreed and granted summary judgment to the government. The court dismissed the overbred claim because it was highly unlikely that, quote, any adaptations of sexual works like Romeo and Juliet will be treated as criminal contraband, unquote. The Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit reversed. The court reasoned that the government could not prohibit speech because of its tendency to persuade viewers to commit illegal acts. The court held that the CTPA to be substantially overbroad because it bans materials that are neither obscene nor produced by the exploitation of real children, as in New York versus Ferber. Judge Ferguson dissented on the ground that virtual images like obscenity and real child pornography should be treated as a category of speech unprotected by the First Amendment. The Court of Appeals voted to deny the petition for rehearing en banc over the dissent of three judges. While the Ninth Circuit found the CTPA invalid on its face, four other courts of appeals have sustained it. We granted certiorari. Section 2. The First Amendment commands, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. The government may violate this mandate in many ways, but a law imposing criminal penalties on protected speech is a stark example of speech suppression. The CTPA's penalties are indeed severe. A first offender may be imprisoned for 15 years. A repeat offender faces a prison sentence of not less than 5 years and not more than 30 years in prison. While even minor punishments can chill protected speech, this case provides a textbook example of why we permit facial challenges to statutes that burden expression. With these severe penalties in force, few legitimate movie producers or book publishers, or few other speakers in any capacity, would risk distributing images in or near the uncertain reach of this law. The Constitution gives significant protection from overbroad laws that chill speech within the First Amendment's vast and privileged sphere. Under this principle, the CPPA is unconstitutional on its face if it prohibits a substantial amount of protected expression. The sexual abuse of a child is a most serious crime and an act repugnant to the moral instincts of a decent people. In its legislative findings, Congress recognized that there are subcultures of persons who harbor illicit desires for children and commit criminal acts to gratify these impulses. Congressional findings estimates that 93,000 children were victims of sexual abuse in 1999. Congress also found that surrounding the serious offenders were those who flirt with these impulses and trade pictures and written accounts of sexual activity with young children. Congress may pass valid laws to protect children from abuse, and it has. The prospect of crime, however, by itself does not justify laws suppressing protected speech. Among free men, the deterrents ordinarily to be applied to prevent crime are education and punishment for violations of the law, not abridgment of the rights of free speech. It is also well established that speech may not be prohibited because it concerns subjects offending our sensibilities. The fact that society may find speech offensive is not a sufficient reason for suppressing it. In evaluating the free speech rights of adults, we have made it perfectly clear that sexual expression, which is indecent but not obscene, is protected by the First Amendment. The fact that protected speech may be offensive to some does not justify its suppression. As a general principle, the First Amendment bars the government from dictating what we see or read or speak or hear. The freedom of speech has its limits. It does not embrace certain categories of speech, including defamation, incitement, obscenity, and pornography produced with real children. While these categories may be prohibited without violating the First Amendment, none of them includes the speech prohibited by the CPPA. In his dissent from the opinion of the Court of Appeals, Judge Ferguson recognized this to be the law and proposed that virtual child pornography should be regarded as an additional category of unprotected speech. It would be necessary for us to take this step to uphold the statute. As we have noted, the CPPA is much more than a supplement to the existing federal prohibition on obscenity. Under Miller v. California, the government must prove that the work taken as a whole appeals to the prurient interest, is patently offensive in light of community standards, and lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. The CPPA, however, extends to images that appear to depict a minor engaging in sexually explicit activity without regard to the Miller requirements. The materials need not appeal to the prurient interest. Any depiction of sexually explicit activity, no matter how it is presented, is proscribed. The CPPA applies to a picture in a psychology manual as well as a movie depicting the horrors of sexual abuse. It is not necessary, moreover, that the image be patently offensive. Pictures of what appear to be 17-year-olds engaging in sexually explicit activity do not in every case contravene community standards. The CPPA prohibits speech despite its serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. The statute proscribes the visual depiction of an idea, that of teenagers engaging in sexual activity, that is a fact of modern society and has been a theme in art and literature throughout the ages. Under the CPPA, images are prohibited so long as the persons appear to be under 18 years of age. This is higher than the legal age for marriage in many states, as well as the age at which persons may consent to sexual relations. The age of consent in federal maritime and territorial jurisdiction is 16. 48 states permit 16-year-olds to marry with parental consent. And in 39 states and the District of Columbia, the age of consent is 16 or younger. It is, of course, undeniable that some youths engage in sexual activity before the legal age, either on their own inclination or because they are the victims of sexual abuse. Both themes, teenage sexual activity and the sexual abuse of children, have inspired countless literary works. William Shakespeare created the most famous pair of teenage lovers, one of whom is just 13 years of age. See Romeo and Juliet, Act 1, Scene 2, 1, 9. She hath not seen the change of 14 years. In the drama, Shakespeare portrays the relationship as something splendid and innocent, but not juvenile. The work has inspired no less than 40 motion pictures, some of which suggest that the teenagers consummated their relationship. Shakespeare may not have written sexually explicit scenes for the Elizabethan audience, but were modern directors to adopt a less conventional approach, that fact alone would not compel the conclusion that the work was obscene. Contemporary movies pursue similar themes. Last year's Academy Awards featured the movie Traffic, which was nominated for Best Picture. The film portrays a teenager identified as a 16-year-old who becomes addicted to drugs. The viewer sees the degradation of her addiction, which in the end leads her to a filthy room to trade sex for drugs. The year before, American Beauty won the Academy Award for Best Picture. In the course of the movie, a teenage girl engages in sexual relations with her teenage boyfriend, and another yields herself to the gratification of a middle-aged man. The film also contains a scene where, although the movie audience understands the act is not taking place, one character believes he is watching a teenage boy performing the sexual act on an older man. Our society, like other cultures, has empathy and enduring fascination with the lives and destinies of the young. Art and literature express the vital interest we all have in the formative years we ourselves once knew, when wounds can be so grievous, disappointment so profound, and mistaken choices so tragic, but when moral acts and self-fulfillment are still in reach. Whether or not the films we mention violate the CPPA, they explore themes within the wide sweep of the statute's prohibitions. If these films or hundreds of others of lesser note that explore these subjects contain a single graphic depiction of sexual activity within the statutory definition, the possessor of the film would be subject to severe punishment without inquiry into the work's redeeming value. This is inconsistent with an essential First Amendment rule. The artistic merit of a work does not depend on the presence of a single explicit scene. The social value of the book can neither be weighed against nor canceled by its prurient appeal or patent offensiveness. Under Miller, the First Amendment requires that redeeming value be judged by considering the work as a whole. Where the scene is a part of the narrative, the work itself does not for this reason become obscene, even though the scene in isolation might be offensive. For this reason, and the others we have noted, the CPPA cannot be read to prohibit obscenity because it lacks the required link between its prohibitions and the affront to community standards prohibited by the definition of obscenity. The government seeks to address this deficiency by arguing that speech prohibited by the CPPA is virtually indistinguishable from child pornography, which may be banned without regard to whether it depicts works of value. Where the images are themselves the product of child sexual abuse, Ferber recognized that the state had an interest in stamping it out without regard to any judgment about its content. Quote, as drafted, New York statute does not attempt to suppress the communication of particular ideas, unquote. The production of the work, not its content, was the target of the statute. The fact that a work contained serious literary, artistic, or other value did not excuse the harm it caused to its child participants. It was simply unrealistic to equate a community's toleration for sexually oriented materials with the permissible scope of legislation aimed at protecting children from sexual exploitation. Ferber upheld a prohibition on the distribution and sale of child pornography, as well as its production, because these acts were intrinsically related to the sexual abuse of children in two ways. First, as a permanent record of a child's abuse, the continued circulation itself would harm the child who had participated. Like a defamatory statement, each new publication of the speech would cause new injury to the child's reputation and emotional well-being. Second, because the traffic in child pornography was an economic motive for its production, the state had an interest in closing up the distribution network. The most expeditious, if not the only practical method of law enforcement may be to dry up the market for this material by imposing severe criminal penalties on persons selling, advertising, or otherwise promoting the product. Under either rationale, the speech had what the court in effect held was a proximate link to the crime from which it came. Later in Osborne versus Ohio, the court ruled that these same interests justified a ban on the possession of pornography produced by using children. Given the importance of the state's interest in protecting victims of child pornography, the state was justified in attempting to stamp out this vice at all levels in the distribution chain. Osborne also noted the state's interest in preventing child pornography from being used as an aid in the solicitation of minors. The court, however, anchored its holding in the concern for the participants, those whom it called the victims of child pornography. It did not suggest that absent this concern, other governmental interests would suffice. In contrast to the speech in Ferber, speech that itself is the record of sexual abuse, the CPPA prohibits speech that records no crime and creates no victims by its production. Virtual child pornography is not intrinsically related to the sexual abuse of children, as were the materials in Ferber. While the government asserts that the images can lead to actual instances of child abuse, the causal link is contingent and indirect. The harm does not necessarily follow from the speech, but depends upon some unquantified potential for subsequent criminal acts. The government says these indirect harms are sufficient because, as Ferber acknowledged, child pornography rarely can be valuable speech. The value of permitting live performances and photographic reproductions of children engaged in lewd sexual conduct is exceedingly modest, if not de minimis. This argument, however, suffers from two flaws. First, Ferber's judgment about child pornography was based upon how it was made, not on what it communicated. The case reaffirmed that where the speech is neither obscene nor the product of sexual abuse, it does not fall outside the protection of the First Amendment. The distribution of descriptions or other depictions of sexual conduct not otherwise obscene, which do not involve live performance or photographic or other visual reproduction of live performances, retains First Amendment protection. The second flaw in the government's position is that Ferber did not hold that child pornography is by definition without value. On the contrary, the court recognized some works in this category might have significant value, but relied on virtual images, the very images prohibited by the CPPA, as an alternative and permissible means of expression. If it were necessary for literary or artistic value, a person over the statutory age who perhaps looked younger could be utilized. Simulation outside of the prohibition of the statute could provide another alternative. Ferber, then, not only referred to the distinction between actual and virtual child pornography, it relied on it as a reason for supporting its holding. Ferber provides no support for a statute that eliminates the distinction and makes the alternative mode criminal as well. Part 3. The CPPA, for reasons we have explored, is inconsistent with Miller and finds no support in Ferber. The government seeks to justify its prohibitions in other ways. It argues that the CPPA is necessary because pedophiles may use virtual child pornography to seduce children. There are many things innocent in themselves, however, such as cartoons, video games, and candy that might be used for immoral purposes, yet we would not expect those to be prohibited because they can be misused. The government, of course, may punish adults who provide unsuitable materials to children, and it may enforce criminal penalties for unlawful solicitation. The precedents establish, however, that speech within the rights of adults to hear may not be silenced completely in an attempt to shield children from it. In Butler v. Michigan, the court invalidated a statute prohibiting distribution of an indecent publication because of its tendency to incite minors to violent or depraved or immoral acts. A unanimous court agreed upon the important First Amendment principle that the state could not reduce the adult population to reading only what is fit for children. We have reaffirmed this holding. The objective of shielding children does not suffice to support a blanket ban if the protection can be accomplished by a less restrictive alternative. The governmental interest in protecting children from harmful materials does not justify an unnecessarily broad suppression of speech addressed to adults. Sable Communications v. FCC struck down a ban on dial-a-porn messages that had the invalid effect of limiting the content of adult telephone conversations to that which is suitable for children to hear. Here the government wants to keep speech from children, not to protect them from its content, but to protect them from those who would commit other crimes. The principle, however, remains the same. The government cannot ban speech fit for adults simply because it may fall into the hands of children. The evil in question depends upon the actor's unlawful conduct, conduct defined as criminal quite apart from any link to the speech in question. This establishes that the speech ban is not narrowly drawn. The objective is to prohibit illegal conduct, but this restriction goes well beyond that interest by restricting the speech available to law-abiding adults. The government further submits that virtual child pornography whets the appetites of pedophiles and encourages them to engage in illegal conduct. This rationale cannot sustain the provision in question. The mere tendency of speech to encourage unlawful acts is not a sufficient reason for banning it. the government cannot constitutionally premise legislation on the desirability of controlling a person's private thoughts. First Amendment freedoms are most in danger when the government seeks to control thought or to justify its laws for that impermissible end. The right to think is the beginning of freedom, and speech must be protected from the government because speech is the beginning of thought. To preserve these freedoms and to protect speech for its own sake, the court's First Amendment cases draw vital distinctions between words and deeds, between ideas and conduct. The normal method of deterring unlawful conduct is to impose an appropriate punishment on the person who engages in it. The government may not prohibit speech because it increases the chance an unlawful act will be committed at some indefinite time in the future. The government may suppress speech for advocating the use of force or a violation of law only if such advocacy is directed to inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to incite or produce such action. There is here no attempt, incitement, solicitation, or conspiracy. The government has shown no more than a remote connection with speech, between speech that might encourage thoughts or impulses and any resulting child abuse. Without a significantly stronger, more direct connection, the government may not prohibit speech on the ground that it may encourage pedophiles to engage in illegal conduct. The government next argues that its objective of eliminating the market for pornography produced using real children necessitates a prohibition on virtual images as well. Virtual images, the government contends, are indistinguishable from real ones. They are part of the same market and are often exchanged. In this way, it is said, virtual images promote the trafficking in works produced through the exploitation of real children. The hypothesis is somewhat implausible. If virtual images were identical to illegal child pornography, the illegal images would be driven from the market by the indistinguishable substitutes. Few pornographers would risk prosecution by abusing real children if fictional computerized images would suffice. In the case of the material covered by Ferber, the creation of the speech is itself the crime of child abuse. The prohibition deters the crime by removing the profit motive. Even where there is an underlying crime, however, the court has not allowed the suppression of speech in all cases. Bartnicki superheld that market deterrence would not justify laws prohibiting a radio commentator from distributing speech that had been unlawfully intercepted. We need not consider where to strike the balance in this case, because here there is no underlying crime at all. Even if the government's market deterrence theory were persuasive in some contexts, it would not justify this statute. Finally, the government says that the possibility of producing images by using computer imaging makes it very difficult for it to prosecute those who produce pornography by using real children. Experts, we are told, may have difficulty in saying whether the pictures were made by using real children or by using computer imaging. The necessary solution, the argument runs, is to prohibit both kinds of images. The argument, in essence, is that protected speech may be banned as a means to ban unprotected speech. This analysis turns the First Amendment upside down. The government may not suppress lawful speech as the means to suppress unlawful speech. Protected speech does not become unprotected merely because it resembles the latter. The Constitution requires the reverse. The possible harm to society in permitting some unprotected speech to go unpunished is outweighed by the possibility that protected speech of others may be muted. The overbreadth doctrine prohibits the government from banning unprotected speech if a substantial amount of protected speech is prohibited or chilled in the process. To avoid the force of this objection, the government would have us read the CPPA not as a measure suppressing speech, but as a law shifting the burden to the accused to prove the speech is lawful. In this connection, the government relies on an affirmative defense under the statute which allows a defendant to avoid conviction for non-possession offenses by showing that the materials were produced using only adults and were not otherwise distributed in a manner conveying the impression that they depicted real children. The government raises serious constitutional difficulties by seeking to impose on the defendant the burden of proving his speech was not unlawful. An affirmative defense applies only after the prosecution has begun, and the speaker must himself prove on pain of a felony conviction that his conduct falls within the affirmative defense. In cases under the CPPA, the evidentiary burden is not trivial. Where the defendant is not the producer of the work, he may have no way of establishing the identity or even the existence of the actors. If the evidentiary issue is a serious problem for the government, as it asserts, it will be at least as difficult for the innocent possessor. The statute, moreover, applies to work created before 1996, and the producers themselves may not have preserved the records necessary to meet the burden of proof. Failure to establish the defense can lead to a felony conviction. We need not decide, however, whether the government could impose this burden on a speaker. Even if an affirmative defense can save a statute from First Amendment challenge, here the defense is incomplete and insufficient even on its own terms. It allows persons to be convicted in some instances where they can prove children were not exploited in the production. A defendant charged with possessing, as opposed to distributing, proscribed works may not defend on the ground that the film depicts only adult actors. So while the affirmative defense may protect a movie producer from prosecution for the act of distribution, that same producer and all other persons in the subsequent distribution chain could be liable for possessing the prohibited work. Furthermore, the affirmative defense provides no protection to persons who produce speech by using computer imaging or through other means that do not involve the use of adult actors who appear to be minors. In these cases, the defendant can demonstrate no children were harmed in producing the images, yet the affirmative defense would not bar the prosecution. For this reason, the affirmative defense cannot save the statute, for it leaves unprotected a substantial amount of speech not tied to the government's interest in distinguishing images produced using real children from virtual ones. In sum, Section 2256(8)(b) covers materials beyond the categories recognized in Ferber and Miller, and the reasons the government offers in support of limiting the freedom of speech have no justification in our precedents or in the law of the First Amendment. The provision abridges the freedom to engage in a substantial amount of lawful speech. For this reason, it is overbroad and unconstitutional. Part 4. Respondents challenge Section 2256(8)(d) as well. This provision bans depictions of sexually explicit conduct that are advertised, promoted, presented, described, or distributed in such a manner that conveys the impression that the material is or contains a visual depiction of a minor engaging in sexually explicit conduct. The parties treat the section as nearly identical to the provision prohibiting materials that appear to be child pornography. In the government's view, the difference between the two is that the conveys the impression provision requires the jury to assess the material at issue in light of the manner in which it is promoted. The government's assumption, however, is that the determination would still depend principally upon the content of the prohibited work. We disagree with this view. The CPPA prohibits sexually explicit materials that convey the impression they depict minors. While that phrase may sound like the appears to be provision in Section 2256(8)(b), it requires little judgment about the content of the image. Under Section 2256(8)(d), the work must be sexually explicit, but otherwise the content is irrelevant. Even if a film contains no sexually explicit scenes involving minors, it could be treated as child pornography if the title and trailers convey the impression that the scenes would be found in the movie. The determination turns on how the speech is presented, not on what is depicted. While the legislative findings address at length the problems posed by materials that look like child pornography, they are silent on the evils posed by images simply pandered that way. The government does not offer a serious defense of this provision, and the other arguments it makes in support of the CPPA do not bear on 2256(8)(d). The materials, for instance, are not likely to be confused for child pornography in a criminal trial. The court has recognized that pandering may be relevant as an evidentiary matter to the question whether these particular materials are obscene. In close cases, evidence of pandering may be probative with respect to the nature of the material in question and thus satisfy the obscenity test. Where a defendant engages in the commercial exploitation of erotica solely for the sake of their prurient appeal, the context he or she creates may itself be relevant to the evaluation of the materials. Section 2256(8)(d), however, prohibits a substantial amount of speech that falls outside Ginsburg's rationale. Materials falling within the proscription are tainted and unlawful in the hands of all who receive it, though they bear no responsibility for how it was marketed, sold, or described. The statute, furthermore, does not require that the context be part of an effort at commercial exploitation. As a consequence, the CPPA does more than prohibit pandering. It prohibits possession of material described or pandered as child pornography by someone earlier in the distribution chain. The provision prohibits a sexually explicit film containing no youthful actors just because it is placed in a box suggesting a prohibited movie. Possession is a crime even when the possessor knows the movie was mislabeled. The First Amendment requires a more precise restriction. For this reason, Section 2256(8)(d) is substantially overbroad and in violation of the First Amendment. For the reasons we have set forth, the prohibitions of Sections 2256(8)(b) and 2256(8)(d) are overbroad and unconstitutional. Having reached this conclusion, we need not address respondents' further contention that the provisions are unconstitutional because of vague statutory language. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is affirmed. It is so ordered.